ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If this thing is built, it will be a miracle to behold.
One of science's biggest promises.
It would be like the Wright brothers moment.
Governments, spies, billion-dollar investments, and scientific rivalries.
The control that's required is rivaled only by what God did in creating the universe.
Will quantum computers change everything? I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Norman, how many hours a week do you think you devote to body hair maintenance?
Not that much, but I do spend some time because I've got a beard. So I'd probably trim the beard 2 or 3 times a week.
Just in general, I'm just going to make a gross generalization. Men have it so good when it comes to how much they have to think about their body hair compared to women.
Do you have to do it? I mean, what's going to happen to you if you don't?
The optionality of conforming to societal beauty standards. Men, we are opening a can of worms today here on What's That Rash, but I'm actually excited for it.
Good, because I have my prejudices here.
All right, well, let's get into it. We are talking body hair today on What's That Rash.
The show where we answer the health questions that simply everyone's asking.
So today we have questions from two people. Arthur and Eddie have both email us, Norman. Mm-hmm. Arthur says, I have seen that in some men's barbershops, they offer waxing of ears, eyebrows, and ... noses.
Well, do you know what they do with noses?
What do they do?
Well, I've seen it. Well, I wouldn't let them touch me with it. Is they dip a cotton tip into hot wax, then stick it up your nose, twist and pull.
Sounds eye-watering.
Eye-watering doesn't come close, I suspect.
Well, actually, eye-watering is the word that Arthur uses. His letter continues, I had it done once, and after the eye-watering effect of the procedure had passed, the difference was amazing. I could breathe so much easier. Arthur says, but my daughter told me that this is a bad thing to do, and so I've not done it again, as fathers must always do what their daughters say. So how important is nose hair? And also relatedly, Norman, from a scientific perspective, must fathers always do what their daughters say?
Well, you're hiding to nothing if you don't, I'll tell you.
Your daughters would say yes. And Eddie says, what about body hair? In some countries, body hair, especially in the armpit or in the groin area, are removed for various reasons. Some of those reasons are supposedly health or hygiene related, especially as hair traps sweat. Is there a recommended practice from dermatologists or others from the medical fraternity, please? I also understand that the removal of nasal hair by, say, waxing is not recommended. Ouch. Norman, these two emails have been such a gift to you and me. We are both so excited to talk about hair today.
Yeah, and rather than just let my prejudice hang there, because people might misread my prejudice, I'll say
like
what my prejudice is.
Like an errant nostril hair.
Well, that's what it is. So some men have like forests growing out of their nose and their ears. And I thought, why? You know, it doesn't take much to actually reduce the forest a little bit.
What do you do?
So I remove ear hair and I just have a little machine that goes bzz, 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 at the front of my nose, but I don't go too high up. So there's no forest ever growing out of my nose.
That's partly how they measure your biological age, I think. I know you're super into the anti-aging stuff. So,
do you have nose hair? Tick, you're 85 years old.
How many millimetres does your nose hair protrude out of your nose?
That's right. Well, 0 is my case, negative.
So I am interested to pick up on a couple of the words that Eddie uses in that email. This idea around health and hygiene and other sort of cultural reasons, because I feel like when we're talking about body hair, well, if we're talking about any hair, we're kind of coming to a coalescing of beauty standards and ideas around hygiene and then actual health information, of which there are more studies than I expected in this space, which we will get into. And it feels like hair just feels very culturally important. You're meant to have it in some places. You're not meant to have it in others. The hairs that you do have are meant to be a certain length. They're meant to be a certain condition. Finding a disembodied hair is about the weirdest thing you can find. We truly love to get very, very weird about hair.
And it's kind of, I woke up to this subject just about a week ago, taking two very young kids to a dinosaur exhibition and didn't realize that dinosaurs actually had vestigial feathers. Did you know that?
So yeah, I did.
And they look a bit like, you know,
they look like birds, yeah.
Yeah. you know, and you wonder, well, it was vestigial, probably didn't do the dinosaurs much good when it came to the bit.
Well, they died, didn't they?
They did die.
And that's what you get for having feathers.
Yeah, that's right. But anyway, I digress. We digress.
We are going to continue to digress, I think.
But the point I'm making is whether or not we're talking about an evolutionary, some vestige of evolutionary development or something that's functional. I mean, I think that's at the core of these questions.
That's a really interesting point. Like, humans are mammal, which means we have skin and fur or hair. And some mammals have a lot of hair, and it obviously does have an important function for them. Like, for example, if you're a polar bear, your fur is doing a really, really important job in keeping your body warm. Humans, mostly hairless, it's harder to sort of know exactly what the function is of it beyond cultural functions, which we will get into. I'm also really interested to talk about how far back hair removal goes. It feels like a very modern thing to do, and it is, but there's pretty good evidence that humans have been removing hair for basically as long as we've had historical information.
Yeah, because cave paintings, apparently.
Right. So there's, I mean, it's hard to extrapolate from cave paintings, but there are cave paintings that date back to like 30,000 BCE, and it shows men without facial hair. So presumably it was being removed somehow. It's also in art. Like, art is a really important way for us to know this, because we didn't have photos. This is what you get. These are the visual representations you get. Greek and Egyptian civilizations showed hairless faces and hairless bodies, and you get this sort of idea of maybe how they did it as well through those artifacts. And in the Greek times, at least, there's a sense of hygiene associated with it. The idea was that infestations with parasites maybe were to do with hair, and if you remove the hair, then you were less likely to get lice and that sort of thing.
But interestingly, pubic hair did survive in many of these cultures.
I think something that's interesting about artistic depictions of anything is that you're not necessarily capturing something as it is. You're capturing something as you wish it was, or that you sort of feel like you're allowed to depict. And the reason I'm getting kind of philosophical about this is because there's this particular painting by Goya, a Spanish artist, in 1800, and it's called La Maja Desnuda. And it's a woman who's lying back on some sheets. And there's sort of a pair of paintings. One of them she's clothed in a similar position, and then one of them she's naked. But it's like the first depiction in Western art of female pubic hair. And I wonder whether it is truly that everyone was removing it, or whether perhaps there was something around the depiction of it that felt naughty or too explicit in some sort of way. And this was a really controversial painting at the time.
And then, you know, you've got photography coming in and pornography coming in. And while, you know, again, there was this contradiction going on, underarm hair in women was considered erotic and then not erotic. I mean, a lot of fashion is deployed here.
Yeah, and again, I think it's this sort of push and pull between depicting things as they are, which is what you're doing in photography, and then also kind of creating standards that other people want to meet. And so as soon as you've got sort of a way of capturing someone's body on camera, you have this ability to sort of show a body to a bigger audience than it would normally be received by. And you can also do that classic marketing thing of creating a problem and then creating a solution to it, which is what happened. We've talked about this in our deodorant episode, this idea of basically creating this self-consciousness around the way your body smells and then being like, ta-da, we've got this thing that's going to fix it for you. And in a similar way, a lot of the fashion magazines, mostly targeted at women from like the early 20th century, like 1915, that's how early we're talking, are kind of looking at hair, unwanted body hair, as this sort of scourge, this real like disfiguring thing that must be fixed.
And some would argue that we're at peak hair removal right now.
I mean, probably. It's very easy to remove a lot of hair. There's lots of ways that you can do it permanently now. And we can get into it in a little while about the sort of techniques that we used back in the day. It's probably safer than it used to be, which I guess brings me to this idea of safety. Like, health-wise, do we have a clear idea as to whether a hairless or less hairy body is cleaner than a hairy one?
Well, let's start with the nose.
Let us indeed start with the nose.
Because that's had a bit of research, not always the best research, attached to it. So the idea here is that your nose hairs are there to capture rubbish that's coming in from outside, capture infections, capture allergens. And the idea is that it might help to prevent infection or even reduce allergen load if you've got a tendency to asthma. And the research has gone backwards and forwards on this. And of course, it depends on how much you're removing. So there is some research that suggests if you've got a lot of nasal hair and you remove it, you get better airflow. The question is whether...
Well, that's what Arthur said in his email to us, that he had this nose wax and he could suddenly breathe.
Yeah. The question is, what do you lose by that? And the evidence goes backwards and forwards on this. If you actually look at the physics of this and the size of particles, nose hair is going to capture big things that are not so microscopic and be obvious. So,
like dust.
That's right. If you've ever been sanding things, you know, it does go up your nose unless you're wearing a mask.
And then when you blow it, it all comes out again and you're like, disgusting.
But viruses and allergens tend to be small and probably escape the hairs. And so the evidence goes backwards and forwards as to whether removing all your nose hair is bad for asthma, is bad for allergens, is bad for infection. And the evidence isn't conclusive. And I suppose where you would land here, just to get past the nose hair thing, is if you're going to trim your nose hair, you just trim it in that very outside part of your nostril, and you're leaving the hair that's inside to do whatever job it was designed to do.
On the hairs that you're leaving there, one of my favourite pieces of research in this space was about figuring out how many nose hairs we actually have. So this actually won an Ig Nobel Prize in 2023, you know, the prizes that they make you laugh and make you think. Anyway, the researchers realised that when they were looking at anatomy textbooks, they couldn't see any detail on nose hair. They didn't know how many hairs there were. They didn't know how far back in the nose they went. And so they decided it was their job to investigate this and put an end to the question marks that have plagued nose hair knowledge.
On living people or dead people?
Great question, Norman. They did it on cadavers. So they, among other things, they sourced some cadavers and counted their nose hairs and found that the human nostril has between 112 and 120 hairs in it. I realised I should have made you guess. I think when I saw that number, I thought that too. I thought it would be more. I don't know how many more. It's not a huge piece of real estate and inside of a nostril, but I really did think there'd be more than 120 in there.
Yeah. And the recurrent theme in this What's That Rash is going to be the health risk is probably more from removing the hair, the process of removing the hair, rather than being left with no hair.
Yes.
You know, you do not want to get a tissue infection inside your nose. Not a pleasant thing and sometimes difficult to treat.
Yeah, inside your nose and maybe other places that people are removing hair as well, which I suppose leads us to STIs if you're doing pubic hair removal.
Down below.
That's it.
As they would say. So this is men as well as women are doing this?
It's actually very, very common. So we do have data on how many people are removing pubic hair or doing things to their pubic hair. 30% of women, 10% of men are removing all of their pubic hair. 65% of women and men engage in some degree of pubic hair removal. And so that's, again, it's hard to know whether they're just trimming those hairs or if they're going right down to the skin. But once you are going down to the skin, you're potentially damaging the skin along the way.
Yeah. So there have been studies of, for example, sexually transmissible infections and pubic hair removal, finding that maybe there is an increased rate of STIs in pubic hair removal, but they're not well-conducted studies and have not adjusted for sexual activity. So it's hard to know whether because you remove hair, pubic hair, you're more likely to have sexual intercourse, for example, and therefore be more exposed to sexual transmitted infections. And it's hard to see how removal of pubic hair is going to increase your risk of gonorrhea and so on. It's going to come from sexual activity. So you'd have to take that with,
let's say,
a pinch of depilatory.
I was going to ask though, like, anyone who's ever shaved or waxed knows that you are not leaving behind perfectly intact skin every single time. Sometimes it can be irritated or you can nick yourself, and that is always going to be a potential site for an infection to enter, whether it's an STI or just a normal other non-sexually transmitted infection.
Yeah, and we're going to have a link to the American Academy of Dermatology. It's got a very good set of instructions in terms of hair removal, how to make it safer. And then in terms of health consequences, we know that hair and hair follicles are places where bugs live, bacteria, fungi, viruses, and so on. In other words, your external microbiome. And the question is whether removing hair, just plucking it, or shaving it, or indeed laser therapy is changing the microbiome in a good way or a bad way.
Right. So we were talking about pubic hair before. I don't know about those studies, but armpit hair and armpit smells have been much more extensively studied than I expected them to be. So there's quite a few different studies that we found where people had shaved armpits or non-shaved armpits or shaved armpits that were then allowed to grow.
Yeah, they had one armpit, shaved, one armpit not.
And then they got women to sniff the armpits and then decide whether not only the quality of the smell but also the attractiveness of the smell was part of what they were searching for there as well.
So there's pheromones sitting in this story as well.
Definitely. We'll definitely come back and do pheromones at a later date and do it properly. And so I guess to kind of bring the armpit studies to a close, I'm not really sure I was convinced what if there was a preferred way.
We'll give the results. People can make up their own minds. These studies where one armpit shaved, one armpit not, the shaved armpit smelled better. I've heard anecdotes from people who've had laser treatment to their armpits that they don't like the result because they feel it's harder to control body odor without that. So I've heard that. That's just an anecdote. Mm. But I think overall, it's considered lower amount of axillary hair, lower amount of bacteria that produce body odor. But I would refer you back to our What's That Rash on Body Odor, where we deal with this.
So as part of my research for this episode, Norman, I have a really good friend who has alopecia universalis, so basically no body hair at all. And she lost her body hair as an adult. And I wanted to know if any of this rang true for her.
And I suppose if you said to this person, you know, how much would you pay to have your hair back, despite all these people trying to remove hair, she'd pay a lot of money to have her hair back, I would suspect.
But the thing that surprised me, and I think surprised her, that one of the most annoying places that she lost her hair from was her nose. Like we were saying before, that sort of function of nasal hair, she was saying that she notices that her nose is way more drippy than it used to be. She feels like she's more susceptible to hay fever than she used to be. And then in close second place after the nose hair was eyelashes and eyebrows. Stuff getting caught in her eyes, sweat dripping into her eyes, you know.
You start to see how hair does protect you.
So let's talk about, we talked a little bit about safe hair removal before, Norman. So I didn't get a chance to really like disgust you with some of the early hair removal substances. Of course, there was at least one that was like ground ivy, ant eggs, burnt leeches and frog's blood. Not as popular these days as it was 100 or so years ago, unfortunately.
No, I could see making a comeback along with red light therapy.
But we have been using razors and tweezers for millennia. Do we have best practice hair removal?
Well, best practice hair removal is really your preference. But, you know, people who looked at this, you know, dermatologists would say the three main types are, four, if you like, are, five. Let me just go through here. But you've got shaving. Yeah. And so done carefully, shaving is safe, but it comes back quickly. You've got plucking and other forms of mechanical hair remover, where the hair may not come back or comes back more slowly, depending on whether you've got to the root of the follicle. Associated with that, you've got laser hair removal, which is expensive and painful, but by and large, the hair does not grow back, although you need repeated therapies. You've got waxing, which lasts longer, leaves you with smoother skin. And you've got depilatories. You've got chemical ways of doing that, usually with a substance called thioglycolate associated with an alkali, which effectively dislodges the hair chemically. All of them have their risks versus benefits. All of them have got to be done carefully. And for much of it, it's preference. But also being aware that some of those techniques, the hair will not grow back. And so you've got to be careful. Eyebrow plucking is classic, where if you overpluck, you will permanently change your eyebrows and there's no going back.
Yeah, many a woman who came of age in the 90s knows this all too well now.
But there is one technique that I haven't included in this.
What? Are you talking about x-rays?
Yes.
X-rays for hair loss. Yeah, it was a thing for a while. There was that beautiful, it was that moment in the early 20th century where everyone was just obsessed with x-rays. It was like, oh, look at this. You can like look inside someone's body. The x-rays are so good. They can do anything. One of the things that the x-ray could do was remove unwanted hair. But as we now know, repeated x-rays can be really, really bad for your health. And so it was promoted as the most scientific method of hair removal available. And it was actually used for about 40 years, which is way longer than I thought in the US, way longer than I thought, and there were doctors making warnings about it and people didn't listen, as is often the case when we're talking about things that are beauty related. We love to ignore the evidence if it doesn't align with what we want to look like.
Or even, as I discovered recently, longevity. People are doing all sorts of stuff which we might be paying the price of in 20 years' time.
So our original questions were inspired by Arthur and Eddie, who both seem to be quite fixated on nasal hair specifically. What is our bottom line to them?
Bottom line is, do what I do. Get one of those little buzzy machines and just do the outside of your nose. If you don't want to look like the forest growing out of your nose and disgust everybody around you. And don't go too deep.
Don't go too deep. That's what you hear from Dr. Norman Swan. Well, if you have questions for us, our email address is thatrash@abc.net.au.
So what's in the mailbag?
So last week, Norman, we were asking people to tell us their N equals one experiments. And Michael very excitedly replied to our call out saying the first N equals one that Michael has participated in is creatine, which we have done a What's That Rash episode on. Michael says, it took me from being an average master's cyclist who could not sprint to win a race to one who could. Michael's actually done multiple N equals one studies. He's written blogs about different interventions he did to become a stronger cyclist. Didn't just take creatine, also made other changes to his training, strength training, increased his protein. But he says, a shout out to the ABC's Dr. Carl, who inspired me to do this. As Dr. Carl would say, the difference between anecdote and data is writing it down.
And we'll put a link to our creatine episode in our show notes. But it's important to say that creatine doesn't do much for your muscles unless you are actually training.
Also in our mailbag, there was a young man called Norman Swan who told me a story this week, and I wonder if he'd like to tell it again.
Norman writes in saying he woke up recently with some of the worst cramps he'd ever had in his life.
What did you do to, I mean, Norman, do to participate these cramps?
So Norman, in his agony, got his partner to go upstairs to the fridge and bring down some pickle juice from the pickled cucumbers.
You did it. You did the pickle juice thing. We talked about this in the cramps episode. Did it work?
Bloody amazing is all I can say. I was in agony. I just feel the cramp disappearing.
Okay. So not only did you have a cramp, which thank you for doing that for all of us because now we get to tell this story, but you had the wherewithal.
I could only just get the words out.
Pickle juice.
Between my screaming. And I did it the way you're supposed to do it, which is that you take quite a lot of it so that the back of your throat, you almost gag, because that's the theory here. And it was amazing. It could have been that they were ready to go anyway because I'd been suffering in agony and it would have disappeared. But I could almost just feel it disappearing.
That is not an anecdote that I expected to hear. So
this is my N of one. Well, this is Norman's N of one. Whoever Norman is.
That's what the N in N of one stands for, is Norman. Okay, I can't remember what we said about pickle juice in our cramps episode.
We actually gave it credit for some evidence.
Did we? Well, there we go.
Yeah, yeah.
Adding to the vast quantity of evidence on pickle juice is Norman's N of one. Pickle juice worked.
If it's good enough for Yannick Sinner, it's good enough for me.
Fair enough. Oh, well, thank you, Norman and Michael and anyone else who wants to send us an email, thatrash@abc.net.au.
See you next week.
See you then.